podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.
Good evening, everybody. We're continuing our series Meals and More. We're thinking about the spiritual significance of sharing food together, based in Luke's Gospel. Kirsty's read to us beautifully Luke 14, verses 1 to 11. If you could look that up, it's page 989, Luke chapter 14. That's not the last thing in the chapter that Jesus says about food, so let's just read on for a few more verses. So Luke chapter 14 and verse 12. Luke 14, reading from verse 12, picking up where Kirsty left off. Then Jesus said to his host, "When you give a luncheon or dinner, don't invite your friends, your brothers, your sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed are those who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who'd been invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, 'I've just bought a field. I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' And still another said, 'I've just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported this to the master. And then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servants, 'Go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.' 'Sir,' the servant said, 'what you ordered has been done, but there is still room.' And then the master told his servant, 'Go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet.' Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, 'If anyone comes to me and doesn't hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple.'" And then just flick down to verse 34. Still a food image, you'll notice. "Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure heap. It's thrown out. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear." Well, we're making the point that although we have to eat, most of us will eat 2 or 3 times a day, have meals 2 or 3 times a day, what we should really be fighting for is retaining a sense of the potential spiritual significance of eating together, as portrayed in Scripture. If you're like me, it's very easy to treat mealtimes just as refueling stops. And Luke's Gospel particularly, not only Luke's Gospel, but it's full of the significance, the potential, spiritual, sacramental, we might say, significance of the physical act of eating, particularly of eating together. And those are the ideas that we're tracing through this series. 2 questions tonight, based on Luke 14, that I've been challenged to ask myself as I've gone through these verses over the last few days. And the first one is this: when we eat with others, what are we hoping for? When we eat with others, what are we actually hoping for? And I think in these verses, Jesus, first of all, points us towards 3 things we probably shouldn't be hoping for when we eat with others. Things that we might very naturally be hoping for, but that are not good things to hope for. So first of all, some negatives. And the first is this: when we eat together with other people, is there a little bit of us that is in judgment mode over others as we eat with them? That seems to be what was happening at this meal that Jesus went to at this Pharisee's house, doesn't it? One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of the prominent Pharisee, verse 1 of chapter 14 says, he was being carefully watched. Do you remember back in chapter 5, we saw Jesus go to the house of Simon the Pharisee, and we saw that although Simon had extended hospitality to Jesus, it wasn't really hospitality. There'd been no kiss. There'd been no water to wash his feet. There's been no perfume to anoint his temples with, to freshen him up. He'd kind of been shown hospitality, but not really. Looks like the same deal is happening in this Pharisee's house. Jesus has been invited to this guy's house to be judged. Do you remember we said that for a lot of the Pharisees, These would have been men who hadn't recognized their need for forgiveness, so hadn't received God's forgiveness, so weren't loving others. And that was the point a few weeks ago, wasn't it? Those who've been forgiven much love much. These men were men who hadn't seen any need to be forgiven, so therefore they were not those who were extending love to others, Jesus included. It looked like he'd been brought there to be judged. And in verses 4 and 6, Jesus asks these questions, and the only response is they just remained silent. They had nothing to say. They weren't going to say anything. They were only there to listen to him, hopefully condemn himself with his own words. He was there to be judged. That was the purpose of this meal that he'd been invited to. Now, that's I don't think, a million miles away from what sometimes we might still be either tempted to do when we eat with others, or certainly I think we're often fearful others will do when they eat with us. On Wednesday, I had a school trip to Knighthays Court. We have this thing at school called community service, and it was the school's field day on Thursday. So all the community service kids who go and visit old folks on a Friday afternoon invited the old folks to join us for a coach trip to Knighthays Court. And we were walking around Knighthays Court near Tiverton in the inside of this lovely stately home. And the dining table was laid out like that. And I was walking around with a particular older gentleman, and he looked at that kind of table layout, and he said, "Oh, young people today wouldn't have any idea what to do if the table was laid like that. They have no table manners at all, young people today." And I said to him, "Actually, if I'm really honest, I've got no idea what to do with a table layout like that." So he explained to me, and he went through that with me. That's what they all are, and you start on the outside, and you go in, and that's for your butter knife, and these for your red wine, your white wine, your water, and so on and so forth. No idea. But I wonder if I had sat down with that gentleman for a meal, and he'd seen me struggle with which fork to use when, whether that would have been a moment to be judged. We've mentioned these shows and their popularity before, shows like Come Dine With Me. And I know this is because it's television and you have to make television interesting and there's got to be some tension and some competition to make it good telly. But if you think about it, a lot of our TV shows are turning hospitality into competition, aren't they? They are literally opportunities to be judged. That's what Come Dine With Me is all about. You go around for a meal at someone's house and then you literally judge them on the cuisine, on the hospitality, on the service, on the decor. That's a very frequent aspect of what it means to extend or to receive hospitality in our culture. Meals become an arena in which to judge one another, judging our social status from the kind of stuff we have in our house, perhaps, or the quality of our cooking skills, or our decor, or our tidiness, or our table manners, or our wealth, or our standards of hygiene. And it might be, that fear of being judged might be why some of us are reluctant to extend hospitality to others. We might fear that if we make ourselves vulnerable enough to have people come into our homes, they might just judge us on any of those aspects. Well, Jesus knows what that feels like. He knew that he was going to go to this Pharisee's house and get judged, and he just went anyway. Do you know what Jesus says? Oh, sorry, what John says in his first letter, 1 John 4, verse 10, there's no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear. And it's Christ's perfect love that drives him to this meal, isn't it? Love for this guy that he's going to heal. Love as well, I think, for the enemies, the very enemies who are going to be judging him. And a love for their lostness and their blindness. If we're fearful about either receiving or extending hospitality because we think we might get judged, let's follow the Jesus example. And remember, that's just not what meals are for. Maybe this is what we're hoping for when we eat with others. Maybe we might secretly be hoping for the opportunity to be judged, or we might be scared of the opportunity of being judged. Maybe we're hoping for this when we eat, Jesus suggests in this passage. Maybe we're hoping just to prove our social status, for the meal to be a mark that you are somebody. Meals is a chance to show off. Look who's invited me. And when I have been invited, look at the way that I'm on top table and you're not. Maybe that's something in the back of our minds. Do you remember this story from last month? Peter Crudas, a government official, was caught on camera selling meals with David Cameron for $250,000. I think £250,000 got your dinner with Cameron. didn't it? And he was promising that your policy request would be considered at the next policy meeting of the cabinet. And that's a real example, isn't it, of meals being places to prove your status. I've been invited for a meal with the Prime Minister. Check how important I am. These guys that were willing to pay this kind of money, if anybody was, are saying. I sometimes, when I'm at the dentist, I leaf through the magazines in our dentist waiting room, and Devon Life is often there. It's the only time I ever read Devon Life. And something that puzzles me about Devon Life is I flick through it, and there's a bit where there's basically photographs of people having meals together, and they're all kind of holding their wine glasses up and smiling at the camera. And it's always so-and-so is standing with the Lord Lieutenant of Devon. And I'm never on those photographs. I just never get invited to those kinds of parties. But the people who are invited to those parties are clearly really chuffed to be there. That those meals are moments to prove your status. Jesus says that's not what eating together is for. It's not for improving or proving our status. He says quite the opposite. He says this in Luke 14. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, don't take the place of honour. For a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. Jesus says that bolstering our own status isn't what eating with others is about. Rather than being opportunities to show off status and splendor, these are opportunities to do exactly the opposite, he says. We'll think about that in a moment. And the third thing that we might be hoping for when we eat together that wouldn't be a good thing to be hoping for is this. Are we intending when we eat with others to actually strengthen and define our own social circle? Is that the intention of eating with other people? Jesus isn't wild on that idea either in this chapter, is he? When you give a luncheon or a dinner, don't invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives or your rich neighbours. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. Jesus says, don't use meals as a kind of transaction. I'll show you friendship and then you show me friendship. I'll have you over so that I anticipate that you will have me over. This is a kind of quid pro quo. You feed me, I'll feed you. Don't use meals like that, he says. Or don't use meals like boundary markers. I'm inviting you in because you're part of my circle. You're part of my club. You're part of my family, my friendship group, my home group. That's why I'm inviting you into my house. If you're not any of those things, you never get invited. Now, of course, what Jesus isn't saying is, he's not saying never invite your friends, never invite your brothers or sisters, never invite your relatives. Of course, we should be doing that. Those are very natural, proper things to do. But he's saying, don't only make those the people that you extend hospitality to. Don't make hospitality a kind of boundary line that demarcates those who you accept and those whom you don't accept. Don't use hospitality in that kind of way. Well, if there are those three negatives, don't use hospitality just to strengthen and define our social circle, don't use it just to prove our own status, don't use it just to judge, or don't be fearful of being judged by others in that situation, it's too important, let that put you off. Then let's think about the positives. What should we be hoping for? What should we be hoping for when we eat with others? And just two under this heading, and then I'm done. Here's the big idea, I think, in this whole series. Our meal, this is what we should be hoping for, our shared food will reflect Jesus' mission. That's what we should be hoping for. And this is the idea that keeps coming through, I hope, in this series. Our meals together, the way we share food with others, will reflect not any of those slightly more petty agendas, but they will reflect Jesus Christ's own mission. If you've not gathered it yet, we're basing a lot of the ideas in this series, not just in Luke's Gospel, but on this book by Tim Chester, A Meal with Jesus. There's one copy left. I don't know how many we bought, but there's one copy left on the welcome desk for £7 rather than £8. So if you haven't got a copy of this yet and you want to get one here, this is there's one chance left. And Chester says this in the chapter on mission, meals as mission, on Luke 14. He says this, meals can be a visual representation of our hearts. Isn't that great? Meals can be a visual representation of our hearts. What does he mean? He says this, consider how your meals express your vision for life. Think about who is invited, what they're served, what you hope to achieve, even the layout of your home. Do those things express the vision of the kingdom of God? Now, I've got to confess, before this series, I had been thinking only in the vaguest terms about those kinds of ideas. And I've found this stuff really, really helpful. So what should we be hoping for? Well, that our meal will reflect Jesus' mission. Now, what does that look like? Well, in this passage, in Luke 14, two things in particular. One, meals can reflect this aspect of Christ's mission. We were nothing, but now we are exalted by God. We were nothing. That's a gospel reality, isn't it? We were just nothing. We were nowhere with God. We were sinners who'd rebelled against him, who deserved only judgment and death. But now we've been exalted by God. Use our meals to express that part of God's mission on this earth. So look at what Jesus says in Luke 14, verses 10 and 11. When you're invited, take the lowest place so that when your host comes, he will say to you, "Friend, move up to a better place," and then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. See the way that Jesus says, make your meal etiquette a reflection of the gospel. Once you were utterly dishonorable in God's sight, and then Jesus Christ died for you. And what God has said to you, if you're a Christian here tonight, and what he said to me is, friend, move up to a better place. Come on, move up. And the humility that comes in a human heart from knowing that we deserve nothing and that we've been given everything, that kind of humility should mark our social etiquette. That kind of humility should mark our table manners. That kind of humility should mark our conversation at dinner parties. That I think is what Jesus is saying in this passage. If we arrive puffed up and judgmental and full of ourselves, if we arrive wanting the place closest to the hosts, if we arrive determined to say the wittiest things, if we arrive determined to be the center of attention all evening, if we arrive jostling to get our photographs in Devon Life, Jesus says, you're not reflecting the gospel at that point, are you? We should arrive with the humility that says we were nothing, and we have a God who has said to us, friends, move up to a better place. If we are hosts or guests of humility, not full of ourselves, not using it as an opportunity to pose and preen and point out how witty and wonderful we are, but using it as a chance to love and serve others and to listen to others and to speak of others, we're speaking of the gospel with our actions and our attitudes, as well as hopefully with our words. And this kind of idea is right through the epistles, isn't it? You can't get far through a Pauline letter without getting this kind of idea. So to the Philippians, make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and one in mind. Don't do anything out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. And if we take that verse into our heads and our hearts, the next time we sit down to eat with people, that will be a gospel-oriented meal. Colossians 3, verse 12, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. So what about just slipping a little phrase in our minds in the middle of that one? As God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, next time you go round for a meal with somebody, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. 1 Peter 5:5, all of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud, but he shows favour to the humble. Now, Chester gives one more interesting slant on this. He says this, we think we're enacting grace if we provide for the poor. He's talking about the way that Christians help those who are poorer than themselves. But he goes on, we're only halfway there. What we communicate is that we're able and you're unable. I can do something for you, but you can do nothing for me. He says that we cloak our superiority in compassion. And he's particularly thinking about the kind of Christian handout culture. I think he's particularly actually got in mind soup kitchens, where we give a bowl of soup to somebody, but we're not actually having any intention of drinking it with them. I think he's got that kind of thing in mind. And he goes on like this. Think how different the dynamic is when we sit and eat with someone. We meet as equals. We share together. We affirm one another and enjoy one another. A woman once told me, I know people do a lot to help me, but what I want is for someone to be my friend. Now, if we can take that gospel humility into our shared meals, that's going to be quite powerful, isn't it? So what should we be hoping for when we're eating with others? Well, that our meal will reflect Jesus' mission, And we're hoping that we're going to remember that we were nothing, but we were exalted by God. Here's the second, final point tonight, and it's this. Let's remember that we don't deserve to be anywhere near God, yet he has invited us to his kingdom feast. Just if you've got it open already, look at verses 13 and 14 of chapter 14. When you give a banquet, Jesus says, invite the poor and the crippled and the lame and the blind, and you'll be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. God didn't invite us to his party, into his kingdom. God didn't invite us to be his children. God didn't invite us, as this contributor to the discussion in chapter 14 says, to the kingdom feast. He didn't invite us because we could afford to pay for our food. He didn't invite us because of our sparkling intellects. He didn't invite us because he was hoping for a return invitation. He didn't invite us to boost his status or strengthen his inner circle or to test us on our table manners. He invited us because he loves us, and he just gives us graciously with abundance beyond what we can begin to ask or imagine. And the cost of his hospitality is paid at the cross. So reading this chapter, and I was thinking, where am I in this chapter? Where am I in this chapter? And I thought, here's where I am. I'm the guy, right at the start, with whatever this swollen condition is, whether it's some, I imagine it as some kind of swelling cancer that was going to kill him. That's who I am in this story. Or I'm the kid that Jesus pictures down the well, drowning down the well. That's who we all are in this story. And God has laid his hands on us and healed us for eternity. He's pulled us out of the well of our own sin. And we are called to reflect that in the way we offer hospitality to others. We don't deserve to be anywhere near God, so he's invited us to his kingdom feast. And that particularly has implications, I think, on who we invite into our houses. So we might want to ask ourselves the question, who in our lives is the guy with the swollen belly who's dying from sin? Who's the kid in our lives drowning down the well, who desperately needs to be welcomed in to our circles and to see something of the grace of the living God? Just two closing warnings in this passage. And the first is this: have you accepted the invitation to God's feast? And Jesus is pretty clear on this, isn't he? A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. That's God. And yet there is this incredibly insulting attitude to the wealthy guy's invitations. Ah, field, oxen, wife. Culturally, all of those were terrible, terrible excuses and hugely insulting to the person who had given them. It might be that there are folks in this room tonight who, you're here and it's great you're here, but you know you're not actually God's. You know that the great man is preparing a banquet and you're invited, but you're saying to God at the moment, sorry, a bit busy, field, wife, oxen, just really can't make it, sorry. Curious, but not coming. Well, here's the warning. I tell you, Jesus says, for people in that mindset, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet. This is a really serious invitation. It's a life or death invitation. It's an eternal invitation that will define eternal destinies. And we must not treat it casually. And the second warning is this: if we are serious about using meals as mission, it's going to be hard work. You know what I'd never noticed before? I'd never noticed that those verses, which is some of the most famous verses, aren't they, about the cost of discipleship. If anyone comes to me and doesn't hate father and mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, even life itself. And of course, we know that Jesus deeply honoured his mother. We know that from his words on the cross to the disciple John, when he told John to take care of his mother. We know that Jesus deeply honoured his parents, kept that commandment. He's using hyperbole here to say, even your love of your parents has to be surpassed by your love of me and your love of the gospel. That's the point he's making, using hyperbole. But these verses of immense call to the cost of discipleship follow these verses about how to extend hospitality. And if we are serious about inviting the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, if we're serious about inviting those who we wouldn't normally think of inviting into our homes, those who are, we know them to be, broken and alienated and ostracized and awkward and difficult, that's going to be a very, very costly ministry. That is going to be hard. Do you remember Robert Caris? In Luke's gospel, this is how hard it was for Jesus to step over those boundaries. Jesus got himself killed because of the way he ate. In particular, the people with whom he ate. This is going to be a tough ministry if we are really serious about it. But look at the effect. Salt is good. Another meal image, isn't it? Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? How effective is hospitality like this shared really going to be? It was fantastic, wasn't it, to hear of what Jenny was telling us about Friends International. By the way, if you give regularly to Belmont Chapel, you are giving regularly to the work that Jenny was describing, because we're one of the churches that supports Jenny in her work here in the city. So if you are giving regularly to the church, your money is being transformed into that kind of heavenly treasure that we saw up there on the screen. But isn't it amazing that most people wouldn't take the risk, actually, of inviting those of other cultures into the intimacy of their own homes? But when that is happening in this city here, it's bearing that kind of eternal fruit, that kind of saltiness. I'm going to pray, and then Grant's going to come and lead us in communion.